who described him as being in a manic state and talking nonsense. Soderbergh eventually surrendered and is being held in jail. In sports, in the NBA, the Bulls beat the Raptors 100-93 last night. Meanwhile, the Bucks look for their third straight win tonight when they face the Magic on the road. Jay Cutler has no problem with fans burning his jerseys after the Bears' embarrassing loss to the Packers. Cutler all but dared them to do it on Thursday, saying it wasn't the first time he's been under the gun. The Bears play the Vikings on Sunday. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. Partly sunny today, a high around 30. To put that in perspective, the normal high for this time of year is 47. Clear skies tonight, a low around 14. Then for the weekend, not much change in temperature. Saturday's high around 30, Sunday's high 32. But the big weather story for the weekend is our first measurable snowfall on tap for tomorrow night. Forecasters say we could pick up a couple of inches. Looking ahead, temperatures holding in the 20s for the early part of the upcoming week, rising to the mid-30s by Thursday. Some more light snow is possible on Monday. The sun will set this evening at 4:29. Right now, sunny skies throughout the region, 22 degrees in Kenosha, 19 in Burlington, winds out of the west at 9 miles an hour. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up. On today's morning show, a talk about the trombone and its immediate predecessor, the slide trumpet. Paul Vanoff is part of a chamber group called Rook, which specializes in early music, and Paul Vanoff also teaches trombone at Carthage College. We'll be talking about the distinctive music that Rook plays and about the concert which they'll be playing this Sunday afternoon. That is coming up on the Friday Morning Show in just a moment here on WGTD. This wonderful music and wonderful music making is the opening track of a CD called 11. And the performers that are performing are a group called Rook. The music that we're hearing is by an Italian composer whose name I do not recognize whatsoever, Dario Castello. And this group based in Chicago called Rook specializes in music of the 16th and 17th centuries.
And the group Rook is going to be presenting a concert this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at First United Methodist Church as part of their Fine Arts at First series. And joining me for this portion of the morning show is the brass player who is part of Rook, Paul Van Off. And Paul is also part of a wonderful brass quintet called the Gaudete Brass. And they were for a time the ensemble in residence at Carthage College and still a very busy group and very, very fine. And Paul, I don't remember if it was you or someone else with the Gaudete Brass who have spoken on the morning show before.
I've been here before.
Okay.
A while ago, yes.
Then it was you. And so anyway, Paul now is part of and one of the driving forces behind this new group called Rook, which presents music of this era in very intriguing instrumental combinations that we don't often see. And so Sunday afternoon's concert is a rare treat to encounter some rare repertoire and a very intriguing combination of instruments. So first of all, Paul Van Off, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. So tell us a little bit about the formation of this group called Rook. How did this begin?
Absolutely. Well, I studied modern trombone in college. My modern trombone, I refer to what we all think of as the trombone today, what you hear in the back of the orchestra. And I encountered through recordings coming out of Europe the idea of music recorded on instruments that would have been more familiar to the composers at the time, primarily music of the early 17th century. I was just completely taken by it. I remember particularly a recording of Michael Pretorius's music that he wrote for a Lutheran Christmas Mass. And I heard all these wonderful trombones playing very, very important, intricate parts. And I had never heard anything like this. This was chamber music in a way, use of the trombone vocally or and rhetorically in a way that I'd never heard before.
And you were a serious trombonist at the time.
Yeah,
one thing if I've never heard this or other people, but you even as a trombonist had no idea that this kind of music existed.
Absolutely right. Even after having a degree in it, you know, a performance degree in it, going through my undergrad and still not having ever encountered anything like this. And I dug a little deeper. I decided I wanted to be part of this however I could. And so I got an instrument made based on a museum piece that had existed from the 17th century, and got an instrument they called a sackbut or trombone, depending on what country you were in, and started trying to connect with people who would play this music. And one of the composers that I got introduced to was a composer named Dario Costello. We just heard a little bit of his stuff. And in Costello's collection, he had published two collections of sonatas, which was, of course, a huge compliment to composers at the time when publishing was not something that was quite as easy to do as it is today. And in this collection, they have this music for this combination of instruments of violin and trombone as the two main frontline instruments, with continuo or violin and trombone. In our case, we also add the idea of the bass violin or the predecessor to the cello and harpsichord. And so Rook is violin, trombone, bass violin, and harpsichord. A very odd combination, especially with the use of the trombone. The violin and the cello and the harpsichord, of course, becomes very popular about 100 years after the repertoire we do with the trio sonatas of Corelli and people like that. But this music of Costello is very, very, very different. I think the trombone fits really, really well in it.
And so you are taking this music and using it as it was originally conceived. It's not that you're taking something that Costello wrote and arranging it for your sort of oddball arrangement of instruments. This is what he wanted. You are being true to his original intentions.
Absolutely. And it is unique that composers at this time, they didn't often put instrumentation into their scores. And so the idea, we do have some flexibility, and some of the pieces on the disc and on the concert will just have been pieces the composer wrote and didn't put instrumentation for at all. Or perhaps we had text, could have been sung, but we know from extensive documentation that instruments and voices were very interchangeable at the time, and so it gives us a lot of license to experiment. But in many cases, we do in fact have the composer writes trombone on the part, violin on the part, and so we can just say this is what he meant, and let's try it out.
That is just wonderful music we were listening to, and One of the things that was most intriguing to me, and I'm sure our listeners heard that too, was that moment when this kind of stately but joyous tempo suddenly begins to race away.
Absolutely.
So does it say that in the score somehow, that you are to be suddenly accelerating at a much faster clip, or is that a performance, a choice you are making?
Well, there are some indications. Costello would have been, in fact, almost revolutionary in the amount of times he'll say things like presto and adagio and allegro. But compared to modern music, there's very little performance direction, no dynamics or hardly any dynamics, no articulation markings at all of any kind. And so we've got a lot of creative freedom. And one of the things I love about working with such an interesting mix of instruments, with the violin especially, is as brass players we all fall into patterns of what works on our instruments. And when you start working with a multidisciplinary style ensemble, you get different patterns. Everyone's different patterns can influence and challenge you to create, to sort of step outside your musical comfort zone. It's kind of fun.
Absolutely. Well, I want to just play that opening one more time, just to give our listeners a chance to hear once again this interesting texture and that change of tempo which I was talking about, which is just electrifying. That is just wonderful stuff. Let's have you talk about the instrument that we are hearing you play.
Absolutely.
In this. So this is the instrument that you had made for yourself. Tell us more about it and how it differs from the standard trombone you
Absolutely.
Play in more standard settings.
Absolutely. Well, the trombone hasn't changed all that much. In fact, of most of the modern orchestral instruments, it'll have changed the least. You'd still look at it and recognize it as a trombone. But the instrument that I'm playing is based on an instrument that was made in Nuremberg in 1632 by a man named Sebastian Heinlein. And what in this instrument has survived, we don't know if it's a typical example, because there are not that many instruments that have survived intact from that time, but there are enough that we can get a sampling, and this is one of the ones that I have not gotten to play many of them, but this is one of the ones that supposedly plays better than some of the other ones that still have survived. And it was copied very diligently copied by a firm run by a man named Egger in Switzerland. They made digital measurements, and they've studied the way that the brass was hammered and the composition of the brass. And so what I'm playing is something very similar to what's sitting in that museum, even down to the early mouthpiece. That is very, very different than the modern trombone, but that's only something that I have to deal with, not something that you would necessarily notice if you looked at it. But it's still got a traditional slide. It's generally, although you can think of it in different keys, it's still in the same key. And so a lot of the things that I learned studying trombone at Northwestern are still things that I can use. The main difference is that these instruments back in the 17th century were designed to fit in with more different types of voices or instruments. So it plays well with others better, I suppose. Is the real difference. It's slightly softer, the articulation is more varied, and could be more varied, and it's a little bit easier to play faster on it. It's more facility. I feel like the modern trombone might be like driving a large truck. There's a lot of power behind it, but this is more like driving a sports car.
Well, that's an apt metaphor, and yeah, I can see how it would be a little more adept, a better fit for some of the really intricate,
Absolutely.
Delicate stuff you have to play.
You've got to keep up with the violin. You need
right.
something that can corner.
Right. Yeah, I should think that's true. You were saying that actually on the second track of this album, again, we're listening to an album by the group called Rook. Their recording is called 11, and they're performing this Sunday afternoon at First United Methodist Church in Kenosha. And you were saying, Paul, that on the second track of this CD, you are actually playing a slide trumpet, the predecessor to the trombone. Tell us more about this instrument.
Yeah, so this is a strange instrument that musicologists actually argue about. It's always kind of cool to see musicologists practically coming to blows in their articles. This is an instrument that we don't have any surviving version of to go and study. We know about it through written documentation and, more importantly, through iconographic evidence. There are many paintings of people playing this instrument. And, of course, it's debatable because, of course, you can't see a painting move. But people have studied this and come to the conclusion that before the trombone, there existed an instrument that looked like a straight Baroque trumpet that you might see playing Bach in a historical recreation or a period instrument performance, but became chromatic in the lower registers by using one telescoping tube to slide the entire instrument away back and forth from the player. And what it, as someone who's performing on this instrument, of course, it's more cumbersome than the trombone, and you can see why they doubled the telescoping tube to make the trombone slide. But it does have a very, very compelling sound. It's more trumpet-like in the sense that it is a true bass trumpet in what Wagner tried to create and only perhaps partially was successful in creating a trumpet sound in the lower register. This instrument really, really did it. It has the wonderful vocal qualities of the trumpet, and yet it's got a power and a directness that is pretty neat. It was an instrument that would have more commonly been found playing with the predecessors of the oboe, the shawm, which is a very loud instrument designed for primarily outdoor use, dances and ceremonial things. And so this trumpet fits rather perfectly with it. And here we use its other role, which was that to fit with voices. There are pieces by Josquin that he suggests the bottom line was covered with a trumpet, and that's, again, musicologically debated what that exactly means. But from as a brass player, I've got to think that it was at least a brass player's joined in and playing all this great music. And so we use it here on this piece by Villert. It's a French piece, which is sort of odd for our ensemble. There's not a lot of French music that uses trombones, especially. But this is it's a cool blending of this instrument with the violin and the bass violin sort of sitting in the middle playing the vocal line while they instrumentally noodle on either side.
Sounds like fun. Let's hear it. For those of you just joining us on this portion of the morning show, I'm speaking with Paul Van Off, who is one of the members of a chamber orchestra, chamber ensemble based in Chicago called Rook. And Rook is going to be performing this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at First United Methodist Church as part of their series called Fine Arts at First. Paul, you were telling me that there's kind of a fun story behind the title of the compact disc that we're sampling today. The name of the CD is 11, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense on the surface of it in terms of an album like this. Tell us where the title 11 comes from.
Of course. Well, in Rook, with our odd instrumentation, the violin, the trombone, the predecessor of the cello, and the harpsichord, as a trombonist particularly, I'm challenged to do some of the crazy stuff that the violin does. And in addition to just having a violin and this odd instrumentation, we all do odd things. So our violinist, in order to keep up with the brass, I got to be, you know, facile enough to keep up with the violin, but they have to keep up with me in terms of the articulation variety and some of the power. So they've done strange stuff to their instruments with equal tension gut strings, and to get and our violinist plays down on the arm to even increase the power of his articulation. Our cellist plays standing up with his cello on a bench, and our harpsichordist is very boisterous in his accompaniment. So there's a lot of intensity in this ensemble. And one of the things that we started almost feeling with this energy we were passing amongst each other, we started feeling, if you can even sort of forgive the indulgence, feeling like rock stars a little bit with the intensity of what we were doing. And in the sort of the chamber music collaboration, we were all pushing each other further and further to take our instruments further. And that felt a little bit like the old mockumentary, This is Spinal Tap, where the lead guitarist was describing his amps. And he said, this amp actually goes up to 11. People are playing on 10, people are playing on 10, they've got nowhere to go. But on my amp, I've got one more, 11, one past. And so we felt that that was the spirit of that is something where you're going to be more communicative, you're going to be more immediate to the audience, is something that isn't just limited to rock bands. And we felt that we could take part of that too. And so we enjoy that. We enjoy the idea of embracing this music right on the edge, even though it's not with volume at all. It's only with the expressive content and the chamber music collaborative content. But we titled the album 11 in reference and in homage to that that quote from Spinal Tap.
That's great. So tell us about hooking up with these other gentlemen that comprise the group Rook. I mean, in some respects, the world of music is a relatively small world in some ways.
Yes.
I mean, at least highly interconnected. It's not all that hard to find other people of kind of similar interest, and yet it can be tricky to find that exact right combination of personalities and talents to make it work as magically as it does with Rook. So
absolutely.
How did you find each other?
Well, I was very fortunate to get to play a performance of Monteverdi's Vespers, which is one of the pieces that's from this period of time that's performed more often than most, and one of the wonderful pieces that used the combination of violins and trombones. Of course, in all tied in with, there's more vocal stuff, and there's, you know, the chamber organs and lutes and theorbos and things like that. But the trombones have a very prominent role, and I was sitting there playing second to the person I was studying the historic trombones with at the time, and the violinist in Rook, Jacob, was playing second to his teacher, who was teaching him to access the world of historic violin playing. And so we got talking at a break, and I said, have you ever encountered this music by Costello? They've written for this, for a combination of our instruments. And he said, you know, I know of it, I've never played it. And I said, well, we got to get together. And Jeremy, who was playing the cello, the bass violin on this performance as well, you know, joined us. And we played trio stuff together, also joined by a cornetto player, which is the, if you could imagine, a hybrid between a trumpet and a recorder. Instrument, which is a very odd instrument, which is present on this album. He joined us for one track. We sat together and we read vocal pieces and tried to get a handle on playing together. It wasn't very easy to fit together at first. Once we felt we had, we were having some success and felt good about taking it public, we found a harpsichord player in town, Mark Schuldner, who was also interested in, particularly in 17th century repertoire. Most harpsichordists gravitate towards the 18th century, Bach, and some of the, you know, some of the more famous names, Handel and Vivaldi and things like that. And then Frescobaldi is a little bit earlier and more in the 17th century, which they also play. But it's very rare to find a harpsichordist who feels the affinity for this particular amount of repertoire, this particular time period of repertoire, and so he was very excited to know there are other people out there doing it as well. Hmm. Most, when you think of early music, most people are thinking of 18th century stuff, and this is as different, this stuff is as different from Bach as Mozart and Wagner.
Yeah. So this is early, capital E, I mean earlier than what we often think of as early music.
No, but without going to the medieval or even the, you know, the early Renaissance, which would be, again, very different still. It's so easy to lump it all together in a category because you don't get a chance to hear it very often.
Right.
There aren't that many recordings. There aren't that many groups in America doing it, although that number is thankfully growing. But it's a wonderful wealth and wonderful diversity of repertoire that I think, as more groups do more than the 18th century, is going to become, it's going to become more popular because people are going to find, like Mark had a preference for a particular point in that repertoire. Like some people prefer Wagner, some people prefer Mozart. Other people will find that they prefer Costello or they prefer listening to Corelli, and that's great that there's a lot of diversity there.
Yeah. We want to remind people that the group Rook is playing Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at First United Methodist Church as part of the First Fine Arts at First series. Paul, what kind of a challenge is it, or what sort of a matter is it to resolve in terms of figuring out that you have time for this? Not even just you specifically, but I mean all of these musicians who obviously do other things in their lives besides Rook. I'm just kind of curious about that. I don't know if it's a courtship or what it is, but you know, that moment when you're kind of approaching other musicians and thinking about the possibility of this might be so much fun that would be worth carving out some serious time in lives that might already be complicated for one reason or another, and probably filled with other music making, I'm guessing.
Absolutely, that's a great question. Of course, as you mentioned earlier, I play with another brass quintet, Gaudete Brass Quintet, and that's very active. We're about to record another album, and very busy, and so it's actually hard. And there are many, many times in the life of a professional musician where you are approached by people to say, hey, let's try this. And those, well, they happen frequently. Anytime that you get that opportunity, it has the potential to be something great. Most often, it's not. You get together, you have one rehearsal, it's a lot of fun, and then by the time the second rehearsal comes around, everyone's a little busy, and you can't quite manage to do that. One of the things I found I'm particularly good at is the organization of managing not only my own schedule but other people's, and so finding times that work for people, and that helps. But it's more than that. When it works, there is something magical. There's something magical about that people like working together, and that you can give comments about other people's playing. I hear this, and I hear this. Let's try to fix this. Let's change this, and you can do it in a way that, the way I give the commentary or the way I receive the commentary from other people is very collegial, and that's fairly rare. And you all look out and you have a love for this repertoire. So if I love this repertoire enough to devote the limited resources, and the other person loves the repertoire enough to devote the limited resources, there's a friendship, an instant friendship almost. You're both not looking at each other and thinking, how can we make this group in any way financially viable, which is obviously a big reach, but you look at it and say, how could we not be playing this wonderful, wonderful music? So we have this, we go in with this love and excitement to share this music and explore this music and to go out and play it. Play it for audiences and have more people listen to this stuff. You didn't know Costello, now you know Costello.
Right.
And that's exciting. That's exciting to me. I love that, and my group is excited about that more people will know this music that we sat down and said, we just love this, and we have to play it.
Well, and I should think it gives you maybe a more unique or distinctive sense of purpose, unlike a lot of groups that we're glad they exist. We're glad there's the Tokyo String Quartet or whatever, but they aren't necessarily carving out a unique place except in the quality of what they do, but they're by and large playing the same string quartets that everybody else is playing in their own way. You are really plowing very new ground, or ground that's very unfamiliar to just about all of us, even those of us that know a lot about music.
Yeah, it's exciting, although certainly I don't think there's enough live music happening. So any ensemble that goes out and plays any music that they love, there's always going to be people who have never heard Beethoven string quartets live.
True.
And so the more ensembles that are doing it, even ensembles at every stage in careers all have value and all have a place that it feels in the professional music world like there's a pie and we're all grabbing for pieces of it, but that's really not the reality. The reality is that music enriches people's lives. It brings people together in a sense of community when you go hear a live concert, in a way that we've somewhat gotten away from because it's so easy to get it digitally in something we listen to in our headphones. But that's not the reality of what music is. It's something that's done communally. And so the more ensembles that are out there doing stuff that they love and are really excited about, and the great thing about Rook and this opportunity that presenters are sort of taking more chances these days on groups that aren't just playing the Beethoven string quartets. If we play the Beethoven string quartets, we know that we'll get an audience. So that's safe, so we feel we're gonna stay there. You're in some ways actually limiting your audience, because maybe you've never heard Costello before, but you might find that really music really speaks to you in a way that other music hasn't ever spoken to you. That's what it did for me. I had never encountered this. And I heard it once and I said, oh, I've just got to play this. I've got to play this so much. I'm going to take a chance on buying an instrument that I've never played, that I can't test out, and that I can't send back if I don't like it. And I just have to do it. And that's as a performer, but as a listener, I have the same reaction to music that I would, that doesn't use trombones or that I would never play, but I just got to listen to it. I've got to buy the album. I've got to go to concerts. I've got to get involved in this, even if I don't perform it. And so we're hoping that people have the same reaction. You might want to come and try it. Come out to the concert, and be part of an event, a public event with other people who are encountering this music for the first time. But any group that's performing live, in any context, whether it's for a group of elementary school kids or in Carnegie Hall, it's all just an incredible part of human expression and human communication. And so whether it's Beethoven or Costello, it's all awesome.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a great concert on Sunday afternoon, and chances are people are going to be hearing pretty much all music they have never heard before in their lives. And that is that's always exciting, especially when it's played as well as those of you who comprise this group called Rook. Again, their new recording is called 11, and the performance that they're going to deliver is Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at First United Methodist Church, which is right on the corner of Sheridan Road and 60th Street in Kenosha. It's a lovely place to make music. I know the Gaudete Brass Quintet has performed there before, so you know that space well.
Do you think
it works well for a group like Rook?
Oh, absolutely. Of course, so much of this music would have been performed in churches, just because that's where a lot of the instrumentalists had positions. That St. Mark's in Venice would have employed many trombone players, just had them on staff, which would have been a great gig.
Right.
Especially at the time, to be in a stable situation and being able to make music with the same people day in and day out, as that you just sit there and you play music all day, every day. I could just only imagine how far they went in terms of playing chamber music together. It would have been really incredible.
Wow.
But so it's designed for these larger liturgical spaces, which is what First United Methodist is.
Well, it's certainly a concert I hope a lot of people are looking forward to. And we're going to finish out with a little more music. This is another composer whose name I have never even seen, I don't think, before. Paul Perel?
Too many vowels in that name to get it. Perel, I think, is what we're guessing. He's a German composer, lived in Horn, and wrote these wonderful dances that actually fit our instrumentation perfectly well. They're dances for a soprano instrument, a tenor instrument, and then the supporting bass. And they're a lot of fun. This is the Courante, I think, is what you're going to play, which opens with a beautiful little harpsichord, improvised harpsichord interlude, and then goes into the violin, and then you'll hear the trombone, and then all together at the end.
Right. And here's a composer who died 60 years before Bach was born. So that's how early we are when we are in the wonderful world of Rook. And Paul Von Off, I appreciate you joining me today on the morning show. This has been a lot of fun, and I hope a lot of people will turn out for what I'm sure will be a wonderful concert Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at First United Methodist Church. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you.
Chamber Group Rook performs Sunday afternoon at First United Methodist Church. It's part of the series Fine Arts at First, a special treat not to be missed. The time is 8:47. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. Finishing out the hour, some fun with a memorable interview which I recorded some years ago with one of the Munchkins in The Wizard of Oz, that memorable film which opened 75 years ago. Reinhard Rabi was the gentleman who portrayed the coroner in that famous Munchkin scene towards the beginning of The Wizard of Oz. Reinhard Rabi wrote a very interesting memoir about that experience and other experiences that he had in the world of show business in a book called Memories of a Munchkin.
Tell us how your connection was made with the Wizard of Oz film. I mean, how did that opportunity cross your path?
After working with the Oscar Mayer and Madison in accounting, they transferred me to the corporate office in Chicago, where I heard through the grapevine that MGM was going to make this movie, and they wanted all the little people they could get. And I thought, gee, that might be an interesting experience. So I asked the company for a leave of absence, and I headed to California. And fortunately, as they still needed more, all the little people that showed up were hired into the studio as to be the little people, as the Munchkins in the Wizard of Oz.
I know that at one point in the book, you give some credit to child actor Jackie Coogan, I think, in terms of why the decision was made to hire little people and not hire children to portray the Munchkins.
Well, of course, that's corporate information that I wasn't privy to.
Right. But the idea was that there were child labor laws in place in the wake of the work of important child actors like Jackie Coogan, which maybe made it a more viable, practical option for them to use little people, which, of course, worked out so very, very well.
Well, like I say, those decisions were not available to me. That was strictly corporate information.
What was the experience like of stepping into this world as a complete newcomer? Were the vast majority of you newcomers to the world of film?
Well, let's say the scenery and the whole set for the Munchkin Land was really so-called out of this world. It was mind-boggling to someone from ordinary way of life. So it was really a tremendous experience. And, of course, to me, it was very, very interesting because most of the other Munchkins were little people with whom I had worked at the various world fairs.
Hmm.
So it's like a grand reunion for us.
Well, and you also talk about how this was back in a day when there were hardly any of the gatherings which take place fairly regularly now with little people, even conventions and the like. I mean, this had to be a wonderful experience for you to be with.
Very much so.
For you to be with so many other little people.
Most of them I had worked with previously, so it was renewing old friendships and, shall we say, being with people that we had worked with before and gathering information as far as their backgrounds, their work experiences.
Hmm. You, of course, were fortunate to be one of maybe 30 or so Munchkins that were given, in the words of one person, special business. I mean, many of the Munchkins were just, you know, we would call them extras on a film set. But you, of course, and others were given some special roles with which you really had a lot of fun.
Well, the casting director had to pick out the different people. He had certain spots that he needed particular people. And the first ones that he was selected were the three little ladies who were the Lullaby League girls. That was one spot he needed, and there were only three ladies who had toe dancing experience, so they were the first ones to, shall we say, get a top spot.
Hmm. There is some dancing done, of course, by the Munchkins, and some long rehearsals happened for that. Now, did you need to be involved in any of the dancing, or was that something that other Munchkins did?
I'm sorry, say that again.
There was some dancing done by the Munchkins in that scene. Were you one of the Munchkins that had to dance, or didn't you have to worry about that?
No, I was not in that part. They had a special dancing instructor to a choreography who taught the ones selected to do these various dance steps.
One of the things that is mentioned in the book is that the vast majority of the Munchkin lines of dialogue and I think even some of the solo lines sung are actually dubbed in by other actors. Is that right?
That was, of course, shall we say, behind the scenes, that we were not familiar to at the time we were working.
Tell us about the amount of money you were paid.
Well, that again was, shall we say, diminutive, just like we.
It was not quite what you wrote.
That was before the unions had had the upper hand in the union, in the movie business.
So not a lot of money, but it does sound like, at least for the most part, you were very well treated.
We were very well treated, and let's say it was a wonderful experience, and it, shall we say, gave me the confidence to carry on, and in other words, keep on going, and not worry about being a little person.
Right. You have very warm words of affection for all of the principal actors in the movie, but
yeah,
you reserve your warmest words really for young Judy Garland. Very much.
She was at the time not quite 16, but she had a wonderful personality, and of course we heard her sing, and she was just very congenial with all the little people. In other words, we had the impression that she got as much of a kick out of being with little people as we did working with her.
Very good. There is, I think, we should give a special word of praise to the composers of the Wizard of Oz, because that whole wonderful musical sequence in which you are a part is an absolutely beautifully crafted sequence of songs, hilariously funny and musically so bewitching.
Very, very much the people who composed that music really did a terrific job.
Meinhard Rabi. He was in the memorable movie of 75 years ago, The Wizard of Oz, playing the role of the coroner. And Meinhard Rabi's memoir about his career is called Memories of a Munchkin. Next week on The Morning Show, we have some interesting interviews for you that I hope you will make a point of listening to. On Monday's program, you will hear an interview which I recorded with Alan Rabinowitz. He is the author of a book called The Indomitable Beast, which looks at one of the most beautiful of the large cats, the jaguar. Alan Rabinowitz has worked tirelessly to save the jaguar. And part of his own personal story is also of how his efforts to connect with and save the jaguar have also helped him contend with a lifelong battle with stuttering. He talks about both of those matters in his new memoir, The Indomitable Beast. We'll talk with him on Monday's morning show. Tuesday, Professor Art Sear from Carthage College pays his monthly visit to the program. We'll be talking with him about the recently held midterm elections. We'll talk about these amazingly low gas prices and much, much more. On Wednesday, 60 years after LBJ's dramatic landslide victory in the 1964 presidential election, we'll talk with Jonathan Darman about his new book, which is called Landslide, LBJ and Ronald Reagan and the Dawn of a New America. Next Thursday, postponed from last week due to a mix-up on my part, we will finally welcome back into our studios local author Richard Nyberg. We'll be talking about his most recent book, which is a really interesting look at the movies of Jimmy Cagney from the 1930s. Of course, Jimmy Cagney is among the most iconic figures from the early first couple decades of the sound movie era. And so we'll look at some of those first films of Jimmy Cagney on Thursday's morning show. And a week from today, We will have for you an interesting conversation with Neil Bascom. 2014 was the 60th anniversary year of the first four-minute mile run by Roger Bannister. And so I wanted to replay my conversation with Neil Bascom, the author of a riveting book called The Perfect Mile, Three Athletes, One Goal, and Less Than 4 Minutes to Achieve It. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org. Click on Talk.